the important thing is that there are discussions taking place.
A weapons shipment appears tied to North Korea. It's Tuesday, October 3rd. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Join us too on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Philippines seeks islet upgrade in South China Sea, India's relief aid and deportation plans, the evolution of Chinese fashion, nocturnal flight in Washington, next generation rocketeers. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Media reports quoting U.S. and other Western diplomats say Egypt last year sought some more than 30,000 rocket-propelled grenades from North Korea in what a U.N. report called the largest seizure of ammunition in the history of sanctions against the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or DPRK. The report said it was justification for the Trump administration's decision to freeze or delay military aid to Cairo. The weapons were stowed inside a bulk freighter flying Cambodian colors, but according to U.S. intelligence, sailed from North Korea. The U.S. tipped off Egyptian customs agents who seized the cargo. The reports indicate the buyers were Egyptian businessmen who arranged the multi-million-dollar deal for the military. It's not clear whether Pyongyang was paid for the $23 million shipment. The revelation comes as President Donald Trump appeared to contradict efforts by Secretary of State Rex Tillerson to communicate with North Korea about its nuclear and missile programs. In a tweet Sunday, Mr. Trump said Tillerson should not waste his time trying to negotiate with, quote, Little Rocket Man, a reference to leader Kim Jong-un. He said, save your energy, Rex. We'll do what has to be done. Korea Society Senior Director Stephen Norper tells VOA's Victor Beatty Mr. Trump's remarks are confusing and likely will raise tensions further.
Some people have made the suggestion that he's trying to play hardball and offset the Secretary of State's reach out in diplomatic ways. But it's rather confusing and certainly of great concern in the sense that it will drive North Korea into a corner and cause North Korea to up its ante in terms of the belligerent rhetoric of its leader.
Secretary Tillerson disclosed Saturday in China that the U.S. is directly communicating with North Korea on its nuclear missile programs.
Most observers have taken that in a very positive light to mean that there are at least three channels of communication. The suggestion is that the New York channel, even though not officially back up, is operating somewhat, and we saw that around the release of Otto Warmbier this summer before his tragic passing. But some communications do get made through New York and also through the Swedish mission in Pyongyang and through the U.S. embassy in Beijing. Those would be the three points of contact. But the important thing is that there are discussions taking place.
However, Robert Manning, a senior fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center for International Security in Washington, said any dialogue underway has not produced a change in North Korean behavior.
Well, I don't see any evidence that North Korea is prepared to give up its nuclear weapons, but I do think that we should be doing everything we can diplomatically to try to persuade them that that's the right course of action. And I see China taking very impressive steps to cut economic ties to North Korea. That could put them in a very difficult position, and maybe they would rethink their approach. So I think it's certainly worth pursuing, though I can't tell you I'm optimistic about the outcome.
Tell me about important steps that China is taking. What are those?
They've told all North Korean companies to leave China. There are at least 100 to 150 that I'm aware of, and a lot of their cyber hackers are based in and around Dandong in northeast China. They're cutting back trade, including coal and textiles, so that's probably worth $700 or $800 million a year to North Korea. So all these things are going in the right direction. Frankly, I think President Trump needs to discover his inner Teddy Roosevelt and learn the value of silence.
China's foreign ministry said it supports dialogue and contact to, quote, promote mutual understanding and resolve related issues through consultations. But a South Korean newspaper editorialized Monday that any U.S.-North Korea talks must not recognize Pyongyang as a nuclear state, or South Korea would have to obtain its own nuclear weapons. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Cambodia's detained opposition leader denies treason charges. former Pakistani Prime Minister's indictment postponed. UNHCR says countries increasingly using refugees as political football. Let's do polygamy. New dating app stirs debate in Indonesia. Vietnamese collector offers antiques to battle China. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. They're also found on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. The Philippines has found funding for the biggest in a series of infrastructure upgrades due on the islets it holds in the contested South China Sea, a move that will gently remind other countries, including China, of Manila's claims. Money from the armed forces of the Philippines Modernization Program will next year fund the paving of a 1,300-meter-long gravel and dirt runway on Thitu Island, which anchors Manila's holdings in the Spratly Archipelago, which is also disputed by China, Taiwan, and Vietnam. Beijing, the most aggressive claimant in those 100-plus islands, as well as the broader South China Sea around them, has befriended the Philippines over the past year, but only after years of diplomatic hostility that some Filipinos fear could resurface. Jonathan Spangler is director of the South China Sea think tank in Taipei.
I imagine there's a feeling that the time has come to consider all other options. I just think it's more like a hedging thing, like making sure you don't go all the way in one direction.
After China parked research vessels over an ocean plateau off the Philippine Pacific coast, Rodrigo Duterte faced public pressure to resist Beijing again. Spangler adds the Philippines can help lock in its Spratly claims by showing human habitation and economic activity. Eduardo Araral, associate professor at the National University of Singapore's Public Policy School, says plans to refurbish infrastructure in the Spratly Islands fits with a natural order of things that any country would do to improve defense.
I wouldn't read too much on this. Clearly, it's defensive in nature. It's routine. It's more part of militarization.
The Philippine military ranks 50th in the world on a list of 133 countries tracked by the research database GlobalFirepower.com. Jay Botambacol, director of the Institute for Maritime Affairs and Law of the Sea at the University of the Philippines, says tighter relations with China also reduce the urgency of bulking up military facilities on the islets for defense or offense.
Overall, I don't think they will put in anything really big at this point. We go by how the government is very friendly towards China.
After Manila won a World Court arbitration case against Beijing, which it was told lacked a legal basis for much of its South China Sea claims, Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte offered to set aside a maritime disputes that had festered since 2012. In October, China pledged $24 billion in aid and investment to the Philippines, but China has officially kept quiet about the runway upgrade, as well as other infrastructure plans on the Philippine-held islets. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for sending us this story. Happening now in Asia, the two women charged with killing Kim Jong-un's estranged half-brother last February have pled not guilty during their trial in Malaysia. A highly toxic nerve agent was used in the murder at Kuala Lumpur Airport. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Glad you're with us today for VOA Asia. Thank you so much for joining us. While it has sent relief to Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh, India has also announced plans to deport 40,000 Rohingya refugees. As VOA's Ritul Joshi reports, residents of a displacement camp in New Delhi are nervous.
The Indian government's plan has upset Sanjida's peace of mind. After migrating from Myanmar in 2012, Sanjida now lives in a refugee camp in Delhi. Her husband is not with her. She supports her family with her sewing machine. Now it is her new home country that is threatening eviction.
How can we go to a different country? Our own country has turned against us. Our mothers and sisters have been killed. Entire villages have been burnt.
This camp is run by the Zakat Foundation, a non-profit Indian charitable organization. More than 200 people live along these narrow streets. Some residents get by taking temporary jobs or running small shops. Some of the children living here do go to school and are monitored by health workers. These impoverished conditions are an improvement over what they left behind in Myanmar.
We have no one. We would much rather be thrown in the Yamuna River instead of returning to Burma.
In this situation, if we have to go back in the middle of this conflict, the conditions in our country are not good. It's scary.
The Indian government claims that the Rohingya refugees are a threat to national security and that they may have connections to terrorist organizations.
They become, a very vulnerable community that could be targeted by Islamic fundamentalists to radicalize them for their own cause, which that possibility is always there. So one has to be concerned and vigilant about that.
We haven't seen any such terrorist or antisocial activity so far.
The future of the Rohingyas in India will become clearer after the next hearing of the case before the Indian Supreme Court, which is set for October 3rd. Ritul Joshi, VOA News, Delhi.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Tens of thousands of people and cattle have evacuated an area around Mount Agung, which remains at high risk for eruption. The volcano has also scared away many of the tourists that sustain Bali's economy. This story and more is online at VOA 60. Also stop by VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We continue now with VOA Asia. The ways people in the West have viewed those in China have changed greatly over the past 150 years. In large part, fashion and traditional forms of dress have helped to shape opinions and thoughts on culture and politics on the other side of the world. From the queue, or man's hair braid, to the women's suit known as the qipao, to the so-called Mao suit, each form of fashion has come to represent unique eras in U.S.-China relations. Sean Metzger, assistant professor of performance studies at the UCLA School of Theater, Film, and Television, explores this topic in depth in his book, Chinese Looks.
One of the things that's been interesting to me is the way, what kinds of new fashions are marking China today. So I think about things like the amount of Gucci you can purchase in Shanghai, for example. But I'm also curious about, for example, Captain America. I had just read in the paper that that film topped box office charts. And I think it's so ironic that an American superhero in the Stars and Stripes was suddenly doing so well at the Chinese box office. It seems like 30 years ago that would have been an absolute impossibility. And today, that sort of seems to mark one direction of Xi Jinping's Chinese dream, right? This idea that you can realize something that's not exactly, but not quite dissimilar to the American dream. You do that within a Chinese context. So I'm curious to see what kind of new clothing people start to wear in China. And I would just return to one of the opening images in my book from 2005, a Newsweek cover with Zhang Ziyi, the actress, in a qipao-like top over a blue jean. And that kind of hybrid image, to me, suggests or anticipates Xi Jinping's drive for a new Chinese dream today, something that's not quite formulated, something that's between the West and something more traditionally Chinese. I think those are the kinds of questions that I hope my book opens up for other people.
Well, certainly over the past century, the qipao has really been an iconic dress that many of us can identify with as Chinese, and even to this day in traditional weddings it's used.
Yeah, that's right. And the qipao emerges in the 1920s and 1930s as a kind of equivalent to what men were wearing. So before the 1920s, men wore as a traditional costume a kind of long gown called chongkao. And that long gown was a contrast to what women were wearing, which was kind of a long tunic and loose pants. So as a kind of way to make women more equal to men, as women started to enter public discourse for the first time in China, they came up with this new dress, the qipao. And the qipao then, as time went on, became much more form-fitting. The hem went higher and higher and higher. So its original sort of political connotations became much more about women's sexuality, particularly in the Cold War period. So in the Cold War period, of course, that meant in Hong Kong, because only in the beginning of the Maoist era in China could you wear a qipao for official functions. After that time, the Maoist government denied women the ability to wear non-Maoist uniform costumes for official events. So, and then that dress was in vogue for 50s and 60s, very, very provocative with its associations with, for example, the world of Suzy Wong, which I talk about in detail, which made it really a kind of fashion trend in the U.S. and in Europe, because that play went, and then the later film, went not only through the U.K., but also through the U.S. Like many fashion trends, it fell out of favor, and then was only sort of revived in the late 80s and early 90s.
So many of our stereotypes of the Chinese come from fashion and the dress and what we see in movies and film. And let's talk a little bit about the beginning of your book and the Q.
One of my readers actually had said the Q actually appears in lots of cultural productions that depict the end of the Qing dynasty. So anything that's set, you know, in some basically 1644 to 1911 in China is likely to depict Qs. But in the U.S., that was a little different because we don't have so many epics about, you know, the Taipings fighting the ruling feudal powers or whatever. So what I noticed was that the Q kept recurring in very particular contexts, and that context was at first melodramas that depicted the Western frontier in the U.S., and then that morphed into what we know as the Western, the film, that is. So that became the arc of the chapter.
The Mao suit is quite an interesting entity of its own.
One of the interesting things that I found out when I was doing my research was that Mao's clothing varied quite a lot. But when the outfit started to register for the U.S. public, and to some extent the European public, people consolidated the variation in clothing in under one term. So whatever people were wearing, they ended up calling it a Mao suit. So that could be like boiler suits for people working. It could be, there are very famous depictions of Mao, you know, with his white shirt and his sleeves rolled up going to work. All of those things ended up getting called the Maoist uniform, even when the jacket wasn't present, which I found interesting. And again, there were variations throughout the communist period. I think it's interesting that in the West, we have tended to say, oh, Maoist uniform is so much about conformity. But in fact, there's quite a lot of variation among the different outfits that people were wearing during the Cold War in China.
The fashion really became polarizing in terms of how Westerners viewed it. It was either good or bad, considering who was wearing what.
To some degree, you still see some of that discourse play out. What I thought was interesting was the qipao, of course, was selected in the Olympics as the sort of official garb for people presenting medals and for many Chinese officials at functions. And that, again, is sort of a marker of Chinese opening, even as the opening ceremonies of the Olympics showcase all of these very different national costumes that people might wear.
You also go into a chapter called Mao Fun Suits, which sounds like a fun chapter to talk about.
Because I work in sexuality studies partly, and also because a lot of people have made different arguments about the ways that Chinese-ness in the U.S. is always bound up with questions of gender and sexuality, particularly for male figures. I think sexuality has been a very vexed question for the Chinese-American male. One of the things I wanted to inquire into was how did those sexual stereotypes play out in different historical moments? How were Chinese men linked to different kinds of sexual discourses? So the Mao Fun Suit chapter was a lot about playing with those kinds of stereotypes. I noticed there was a whole bunch of artistic projects that were just that. They were just experiments to see what kinds of meaning might be produced by these different kinds of discourses circulating around China and Chinese costumes.
Sean Metzger, Assistant Professor of Performance Studies in the UCLA School of Theater, Film, and Television. He's also the author of Chinese Looks, Fashion, Performance, and Race. This news alert from VOA Asia, both the United Nations and World Food Program are seeking emergency financial aid to alleviate the suffering of thousands of Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar as lines for food continue to grow in refugee camps. All the big stories come your way on VOA 60 Online and VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, right here in Washington, D.C., we're home to 9 species of bats. They play a vital role in the ecosystem, but biologists are worried that some may have contracted a deadly disease called white nose syndrome. VOA's Veronica Baldegras Iglesias went on a so-called bat walk with the researchers on an island in the middle of Washington's Anacostia River.
A man-made island in Washington, D.C. provides an ideal setting for biologists who study bats. What scientists do is install these temporary nets to trap bats so they can be studied and checked for any disease. With a grant from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, biologists are focusing on whether these nocturnal mammals suffer from the so-called white nose syndrome. Since 2007, the mysterious disease has killed more than 6 million bats in North America.
They typically have one pup a year when they reproduce. So that's another reason that white nose has been so detrimental. You know, they don't have a lot of babies.
The syndrome is not contagious to humans, but people entering caves may unintentionally carry in spores of the fungus that causes it. In these dark, wet conditions, the fungus spreads rapidly and leads to erratic behavior in bats, explains biologist Lindsay Roba.
These bats are arousing more often than they're supposed to be during hibernation. And when they do that, they're unable to find food and they unfortunately die.
The deaths of these important pollinators have direct consequences on the quality of human life, Roba says.
Without bats, we're seeing an increase in mosquitoes and other pests that are decimating food sources for us. And I think that's only going to get worse over time if we don't find some way to protect the species that we have left.
One theory is that certain bat species no longer return to caves to avoid contamination, and their presence in cities makes it increasingly important that humans know how to behave if they encounter a bat.
They should not touch it and not disturb it. I don't want anybody being bit on the very 1% chance that bat has rabies. They should call their animal control officers to come and remove the bat for them.
Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Rockets that will take Americans back to space from U.S. soil for the first time since the retirement of the space shuttle fleet in 2011 could also launch new careers in space science. VOA's Faith Lapidus looks to the stars.
As Voyager 2 nears the outer edge of our solar system, workers at the United Launch Alliance Rocket Factory are preparing for the next phase of America's space exploration.
Within this rocket factory, we have about 23, 24 missions in work at any given point in the day.
United Launch Alliance builds Atlas and Delta rockets, which traditionally have carried cargo or robotic science missions.
Over the last 10 years, United Launch Alliance has assembled and launched rockets for more than 115 missions, ranging from the Mars Science Laboratory, which is a Curiosity rover, Juno mission. Now we're getting more into the manned spaceflight side of things and really returning manned spaceflight back to American soil.
That opens the door for young aerospace engineers and scientists to start to develop the hardware and systems to carry astronauts to and from space.
So this is really history in the making. This is really the Apollo era for the next generation. This is inspiring this next generation to fall in love with space again, to really test their boundaries and us paving their way for the future of commercial space exploration.
3, 2, 1. We have liftoff.
Several test flights, including a crewed mission, are planned for next year. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia, and some have been listening in China and Taiwan via the voice of Chengrong, Star Radio FM 88.3 at Chengrong Christian University in China and Taiwan. Thank you for joining us today. Our thanks to Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Dave Magnus, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Ali Ogden, Ira Melman, David Bird on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We hope you have a great day ahead.